The 1320 KLWN Weather Center. I'm meteorologist John Weatherby.
News and talk of Lawrence, 1320 KLWN 906. It is time for the Lawrence Business Magazine Show right here on 1320 KLWN. And here's your host, Ann Frame Herzog.
Thank you, John. Well, each week we have in-depth conversations to follow up and explore the people and businesses making a positive impact on Lawrence. And today I'm pleased to have our woman of impact, Sarah Hill Nelson. She's the CEO of Bowersock Mills and Power Company. And thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
So, Sarah, usually we always talk, have everybody give us a bit of history about how people are here in Lawrence. Sarah's got a longer history than a lot of people here with Lawrence. So let's talk a little bit about your history and how you've been in Lawrence, but also you left Lawrence and are back in Lawrence. Let's talk a little bit about you.
Sure. well, first of all, thanks for inviting me. I'm glad to be here. I do have our family has a long history here. My great-great-grandfather, J.D. Bowersock, established the Bowersock Mills and Power Company, and he had a grist mill there. Actually, it was his father-in-law, James Gower, that had a grist mill on the Kansas River. He was in Iowa, and J.D. was running it for him. And so we started out here in Lawrence in the late 1800s, and then the powerhouse was in my family through the 30s, and then it went out, and then it came back again. So we've kind of watched that operation all the way along. My dad bought it back in 1972. So then my great-grandfather mm-hmm. and my grandfather and all my uncles all grew up here in Lawrence and went to Lawrence schools, and everybody went to KU. And mm-hmm. Many of them left and explored and went off and got graduate degrees elsewhere and then came back to Lawrence. And mm-hmm. I did the same thing. I grew mm-hmm. up here, and I graduated from Lawrence High, and I went away to college. I went back east to go to school, mm-hmm. and then after school, I lived in Chile and California and Wyoming. And
now, what were you doing down there? What were you doing in Chile?
I spent my junior year in Chile, and I just fell in love with Chile. I mm-hmm. wanted to be Chilean. It has mountains and ocean, and it's an incredibly beautiful country. And so I graduated from college, and I went back down, and I was a bilingual secretary in Santiago. So,
oh, wow.
And I worked for an import-export company, and I just lived in Santiago and kind of pretended
totally
I
different
was
from
Chilean. Yeah. And I ultimately realized that, you know, it's a difficult – I mean, I missed mm-hmm. – I'm never going to be Chilean, and I missed that seamless integration mm-hmm. into a community. And so then I lived in Wyoming a little bit before I went back to Chile. Then I went back and became a teacher. I lived in California, and I taught history at the Thatcher School in Ojai, California.
Okay.
And then
it's
I went
beautiful
to,
up there.
Oh yeah, it's very beautiful. And boy, teaching is the hardest job I've ever had.
So you have a good spirit of adventure there.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I love to go teaching was the hardest job I've ever had. I still feel like I'm on vacation. I taught in California, and it was so hard that I thought, okay, well, if I get more education, it's going to get easier for me. And so then I went and I got a master's degree in history and a master's degree in teaching, thinking, okay, well, then it's going to be easier. I was up in Seattle, and I had a scholarship to go to school. I had a Truman Scholarship, and I used that to get my master's degrees. And then I went back to teaching, and I taught in Seattle at Lakeside School, another really great and interesting school. And I just, every day, I have so much respect for teachers. It, for whatever reason, and I could dig into that a little bit more, but it just wasn't a great fit for my personality. For one, I'm a really deadline driven, and so then I had met my husband, the person who's my husband now, Eric Nelson, and very fortunate to have met him. And we moved to Colorado together, and that was kind of my ripcord. It was my way to say, oh well, okay, I'll follow Eric to Colorado. And then I started working in a not for profit, and I progressively got more relaxed. You know, some people say, oh, I'm going to go be a teacher. Life's, you know, jobs are too hard. I'm going to be a teacher. That's more relaxing. I'm more relaxed now than I've ever been. You know, I was a teacher, and I was really uptight. And then I went to work for a not-for-profit, and I was less uptight. And now I work for a business, and I'm I'm probably less uptight overall.
But you're also now your own boss,
which
in many ways,
right? Which is
you still
a
answer
huge
to people,
relief.
You're bored and everything like that, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I felt boss. So much when I, you know, as a teacher, I felt all this on my shoulders of, you know, all these kids. Oh, if I don't spend all this time on their papers, it's going to be, you know, I'm taking it away from them. Now, if I don't get into work, it's a piece out of me. I'm the one that has to pay the price. So I feel less of a burden that way.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Now living in the different places, and that's one of the things what we were talking about actually before we came on the air. I was talking with Sarah, is because we have both lived, we're both from Kansas, but we've lived outside and gone different places, and we have both moved back to Lawrence. So what kind of a perspective? I mean, that's a different perspective than just, you know, growing up in Lawrence and staying here, which is a wonderful thing to do. But what kind of what does that give you, having lived so many other places?
I feel so fortunate that I've been able to just reach out and explore and live in all those other places. And I think it really gives me a deep appreciation for this community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we feel sometimes this inherent sense of insecurity. You know, we're from Kansas. People make fun of us. And and I, you go and you live in these other places and you're like, really? You want to live in Jersey? Because it's not that great there. Like, I mean, it's fine in Jersey.
Yeah,
don't get me wrong.
There's a lot of great places to live.
But they have really bad traffic and it's really expensive. And frankly, it's just as beautiful here. And our quality of life is in my estimation, far higher. So I really I loved Seattle. There are times that I really miss it. There are days that I miss the mountains. But I think that I have such an appreciation for, you know, getting outdoors here in Kansas. And there are other ways to do it. It's a more subtle beauty. And so I think I was stretched, I grew, and I came back. And it's not that I can't see places where Lawrence can and should grow. You know, yeah. I've seen examples of, oh, I'd like to have that. Mm-hmm. That community had that. I could try to say, let's try to bring that here. But I also, it gives me a sense of peace that I've been and, you know, lived these other places. I've experienced that and I know what it is. It's good, but I can say, you know, this, what we have here is very good.
And probably also, what I also think you're saying too is you can see where we can go in a different way too, instead of just, when you see how other communities do things, it gives like, well, we don't want to do that, or this is really good. Kind of gives you a little bit of perspective on where you want to go.
It really, I've seen some great models, and there are things that you love about these other communities, and you think, oh, I want to take that back to Lawrence. You know, one of the fantasies I have is that I want more public trails and access to the outdoors, and that's something that really drives me. And I just joined the Friends of the Caw board, and I want to. That's something that I really am going to work on. So, it makes life more fun.
Well, now after living all these places, now I know I was, you know, we in the magazine on our Women of Impact issue, we talk about it, that you and Eric then moved back to Lawrence, because then your dad was needed somebody to help run the plant, right?
Yeah.
And so he said, well, Eric, do you want to do this, right? So you and
and he did. We, not that we're sexist, but we just sort of assumed that this would be his job. And definitely running the powerhouse, I mean, it is a hard job, and it requires guys that are really smart and don't like to sit in one place all day. And my husband is a really smart guy, but you know what he missed was the human interactions. You know, there's a certain type of person that has an acumen with machines, and they can see it, and there's an art to that. Mm-hmm. And my husband loves teaching, and he loves working with kids and students, and you really see his gifts there. And I think for him, leaving teaching, you know, just like for me, leaving Lawrence allowed me to come back and appreciate it. Leaving teaching for a little while for him helped him realize, okay, this is what I love about teaching, and this is what I love about working with kids. So he's more at peace, I think, you know, knowing that, okay, I've done these other things, and this is what I love about teaching. So I sort of slipped into the job at Bowersock. Like I just started paying the bills, and then I started negotiating our contract with Westar, and then I just started getting, you know, more and more involved down there, and I love my job there.
That's great. So now I find that interesting because one of the things I'm always talking about with people, I have a liberal arts degree, and I do marketing, and so, and we have, you know, there's other areas to get into, and we always talk about how having a liberal arts degree, how that, you know, influences you. So I mean, and your work.
I think actually a lot of my work that I, you know, having taught. I do a lot of presenting. I do a lot of working with the public, a lot of having, you know, public meetings and explaining to people, okay, here's what we're going to do with Bowersock. Part of being in a something like Bowersock, it's we're using a community resource. We're using the river. It's critical that we have open communication with everybody. Everybody understands what Bowersock's doing. And we have to bring in people to collaborate with us. So, you know, we had to bring North Lawrence on board, and we had to work with the city of Lawrence. We have to work with the state. We have to work with the feds. And so all I think that my teaching skills, all my research skills, my writing skills as a history teacher, I wrote our FERC application. You know, we have to do a lot of that.
Okay,
and
FERC. Now that's
I'm sorry. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And they are a big part of my life. I spend a lot of time working with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission because they pretty much tell us to jump and we say how high. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I really think that you know, people are like, "Oh, do you have an engineering degree?" Mm-hmm. But my experience, we definitely rely on our engineers, and we have to have those people. But I often think that there needs to be a translator between the engineers and the people doing the technical work in the community. Mm-hmm. And I think I serve as that role. I can help try to put things in everyday language. Mm-hmm. You know, we had an experience at one point where one of the engineers came out and tried to do a presentation to some community members, and I was like, "Oh, stop right now!"
You know, just confusing the issue.
He's confusing the issue, and God love the engineers, but we can't live life without them. But no. I think there's a real role for people for kind of an intermediary that has the 60,000-foot view.
Well, I think having, when you just talk about the translation, probably having lived in Chile and speaking Spanish and stuff, you understand the translation, that what can be lost in translation there from and then just engineering speak to regular speak, that translation process.
That's actually a really good point. I never thought about that before, but I do, and there are, I have to be able to take the technical and explain it to the community, and that is, a lot can get lost in translation.
Now, having grown up your family with having this kind of the mill and the power company being kind of so much a part of your history, how did you feel though when you got in there? How much of an education, and how has it changed so dramatically then from when you were a kid? Because the 73, when your dad bought it back, and you were pretty young.
I was, and I mean, I remember spending time down there as a child with all the old guys that ran the plant. I mean, that plant's been around there since 1905, that powerhouse itself. And so we did a lot of things old school, and so I've watched it in the new powerhouse in particular. You can go from the old powerhouse to the new powerhouse, and now we have all this SCADA, which is supervisory control and acquisition, or in data acquisition systems. So, you know, all of this is electronic, and we've got so much more controls as far as the power distribution. So we've had to continually step it up at Bowersock. But by the same token, this morning I was down there, and, you know, the guys are still saying, you know, we had this great idea. We got these Chinese units in, and there was this extra packing steel that they used to pack those in the
crates. I'm going to put you on hold, because I want to talk more. You know, we're going to break here, but I want this is exactly where I'm going to go. I want to talk about what's happening down at the plant now, because you've got some of that and some other news about what's going on down there when we come back.
That sounds great.
Right here on the News and Talk of Lawrence, 1320 KLWN.
Lonnie Blackburn here from Academy Cars. The doctor told me to turn it down a notch so my heart doesn't explode. Now I need some way to get your attention besides screaming. That puts me in a real pickle. So here's what
61 tomorrow. Saturday, mostly cloudy. A 20% chance of rain or drizzle. Gusty south winds, high of 63. From the 1320 KLWN Weather Center, I'm meteorologist John Weatherby.
924, 1320 KLWN, continuing with the Lawrence Business Magazine show, and your host once again, Ann Frame Herzog.
I'm here with Sarah Hill Nelson, the CEO of Bowersock Mills and Power Company. And before the break, we started talking about the new units that they have down at Bowersock and some of the Chinese steel that when you had when the units were packed, you said that things came in with the Chinese steel, right? Then so Sarah's giving us a little what happens with this? You were saying something happened with the steel.
Yeah, well, we have. I was saying, you know, you asked how the plant had transitioned,
right?
You know, from when I was a little kid to when. And one of the things that I really felt as a child, you know, you'd go in there and you'd see these old guys and they were just making do. You know, you have materials, you make it work. We were operating on a shoestring at that time, just farm ingenuity. You know, guys that are like, okay, here's the materials at hand, this is what we're going to do. And this morning I went down and our lead man, Mark Maxwell, was saying, okay, well, we needed a new control arm. We just broke one of our control arms. And so we had this extra steel that the Chinese, our brand new Chinese units were packed in this extra steel, and it's great steel. And Mark said, well, we're going to use that extra steel and use that to make our control arm. And the guys will fabricate that control arm. So to me,
that's
just a classic example of a little bit of old school,
mm-hmm.
but it works. It works really well, and it's really sustainable. So, and I think that our new powerhouse is just a continuation of showing this. We're still maintaining a lot of the old and charging into the new.
So all the old units, so you have the old units that are still working.
Oh, yeah.
That have been working. And
how many
of those are there?
So we have, on the south side, we have 7 small units. They're about 300 kW apiece. And then on the north side, we have 4 units, and they're about 1,000 apiece,
wow,
approximately.
So
they're
big,
much bigger. We have 4 big ones on the north side, and we have 7 little ones on the south side.
Okay.
And so on our north side, 2 of our units are brand new. They're from China, and I'll touch on that in a little bit.
Okay.
2 of our other units are actually, we bought used out of a powerhouse. They were originally operating in a powerhouse in Maine in the 1930s.
Wow.
And that's why hydro...
It hasn't changed that much.
It has not. Really, that science was mature at the turn of the century.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they knew how to do the pitch on those blades. They knew how to put together a turbine to have it be the most efficient possible. So... we found these units, and our guys rehabilitated them, and we've reinstalled them in this new powerhouse. And they're really very similar to these brand new units that we bought from China. And
wow.
So you said, well, why do we buy the units from China? I had somebody stop me on the street. Oh, we're so disappointed you bought Chinese equipment. Why did you do that? And I said, well, we had 2 old units. We used fully American labor to rehabilitate them, and we had guys down in Georgia working on our generators and our turbines and... But you basically cannot get hydro equipment of this size that's made in the United States today. So you really have to buy it from China.
Okay.
So it's going to be a lot of fun for us to watch these 2 older units and the brand new Chinese units and see how they perform side by
mm-hmm.
side. And definitely the Chinese units are they're a little sexier, you know.
They're newer.
And they're stainless, and they've got this more aggressive pitch on the runner, the pitch of the blade. But, you know, then the guys will be like, well, we'll see how that's going to handle the debris. You know, so it'll be really fun to kind of compare the two. And I think it's just our whole project is a really nice way to view the transition of hydroelectric power, you know, how it's changed and how it's stayed the same. And really the biggest changes in that new plant are all in the electronic controls. And that's really the way that hydro's developed.
Now, when you say electronic controls, it's the controls to not only, work the equipment, but then also controls on how you take the equipment and the efficiency of the electricity is created and where it goes.
Yeah, well, it's mostly on the electrical end. Like when we control a unit, speeding it up and slowing down the unit, because when you get a unit online,
mm-hmm.
you have to get your unit up to speed so that you can jump on the grid. It's basically like jumping into a double Dutch jump rope.
Okay.
So we open up the gates, we let the water into the unit. That unit has to get up to speed so that when we put it on the grid, it's going to be making electricity at the same rate as the grid.
Okay.
If you're off from the grid, it's going to kick you off. And our old powerhouse, there's really an art to it, and I can actually listen to who's putting the units online, and really, most of the time, I can tell who's putting it on, because everybody has a different style. And we use these flashing lights and a synchroscope, and you put it on. Well, now our new units, it won't let you. It's got a sync check on it, and you won't let you put that unit online unless it's perfect.
Oh, wow.
So that's the kind of advance you have. We have this really great-looking switchgear. Mike Schmatter of Mid-States Electric did all of our high voltage electrical and got us the switchgear, which we actually also got used from Greensburg because it was this switchgear that had been installed a couple, it was hardly used at all. And it was brand new in Greensburg before that tornado hit.
Right.
And then they ended up reconfiguring their powerhouse. So we just repurposed that switchgear. So, yeah.
Now, I want to stop for a second here because we're going to talk more about the plant, but I also, I want the grid. Everybody, I hear that grid when we're talking about energy and we have to upgrade the grid. We got to do this to the grid. Can you give us a kind of a layman's explanation of what the grid is?
Yeah. Imagine, I mean, every plug in your house is, imagine a map where you could draw a line. Mm-hmm. And the lines are all the electrical wires connecting every plug with every power generation source all over the United States. So if you look in your house and you look at your plug, and if you had a map that you could trace the electrical wires, there's going to be a path between your plug. You're going to be able to get to the Lawrence Energy Center, or you're going to be able to get to Bowersock. And you can think of it as a highway of these electrical wires going everywhere. So when we refer to the grid, you're talking about everything from the largest power stations, all the transmission lines, all the little lines going down the streets, the underground lines, everything that's on power poles, everything that goes into your house, all the way out to your electronic receptacle there. It's all a part of the grid.
Okay.
And basically, when we are taking electricity from the grid, it's you have to, the grid is like a swimming pool. Okay, imagine that the water is the electricity.
Okay,
this is another way to look at it. And the drain in the bottom of the pool is people consuming that electricity.
Okay,
and then imagine that there's maybe 100 spigots around that pool, and each spigot is pouring water into that pool at a different rate. And we might even like to think of some spigots as pouring in black water. Some are pouring in nice, clean water. And you have a guy that's running around, or a girl, right, that's running around, opening and closing those spigots to various amounts to ensure that there's always the right amount of water in that pool. Because you can't have too much water going in the pool, or it's going to spill out and it's going to cause problems. And if you can't, if the water's getting sucked out of the bottom too quickly, that pool's going to drain out, and that's when you get blackouts or brownouts.
Okay.
So in Lawrence, we're in a group called the Southwest Power Pool, and they manage a territory that's really kind of a crazy geography. It's part of Louisiana, Oklahoma, Nebraska, Kansas, parts of Missouri. And they're looking all day long, and they're managing to make sure there's enough electricity, okay, or enough water in that pool that everybody's going to be able to turn the lights off or on. And so they're saying, okay, how hot's it going to be today? How windy is it going to be today? And then if they see that there's going to be a shortage, they're going to call up somebody at Westar Energy and say, hey, we need you to put a couple more of your gas-fired units online.
Okay.
So Westar will then respond and put more of their gas-fired units online, or maybe put another coal-fired unit online. And so that's how we maintain enough electricity in the grid to feed the community. And when you are pulling at your house, okay, imagine that swimming pool. You take a dipper, and you're pulling water out to serve your house. You don't really know whose water, where'd that water come from? You don't know, because once it gets in the pool, it gets all mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
So you at your house might be pulling electricity that was generated at Bowersock, or you might be pulling electricity that was generated at the Lawrence Energy Center by Westar Energy. So, but the way that you, it's all accounted for, everybody that generates keeps track of how much they put in the grid and how much their consumers take out.
So when you say your consumers, who are your consumers then?
Well, we're only allowed to sell wholesale.
Okay.
Bowersock. Because of a lot of the Kansas legislation and rulings on that. So, for Bowersock, say, for example, Westar Energy.
Okay.
They're keeping track of how much energy are they responsible for getting on the grid?
Mm-hmm.
How much are their consumers taking? If they have excess energy that they're generating, they might sell it on the spot market. Somebody up in Nebraska might need it. They might say, okay, we'll sell you this chunk.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually, it's kind of complicated.
Yeah.
So
I understand kind of the uploading and downloading, but where are is it the power stored anywhere?
Well, that's our big challenge with power.
Yeah.
In electricity, we can't store it.
Mm-hmm.
We and that it's is always a huge live. Problem. It's live all the time. And that's one of our biggest challenges. That's one of our if we could develop some awesome battery technology, mm-hmm. you know, with wind power, you could be generating wind power all night long when the wind's really blowing, and then you could use it the next day. But the problem is, it's like use it or lose it. You know, you can, it has, it's basically all real time. So, if, you know, say with wind power, mm-hmm. like the day that you might really need it, it might be really hot and the wind might not be blowing.
Right.
So where we have to go with our energy generation, we've got to figure out ways to store that energy mm-hmm. so we could generate the energy and then hold on to it till people actually need it.
Mm-hmm.
But since we don't have that capability, it's all real time and you're constantly responding to what the
constantly juggling basically.
Exactly.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and that's going to be a big challenge for us. And you know, hydro is a way you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
You can a reservoir can serve as a battery, basically. Like at night, you could use that wind
mm-hmm.
to that excess wind to pump that hydro up into a lake or reservoir facility, and then during the day, when everybody turns their lights on and they need it, and the wind's not blowing, you could run that water down through units and generate electricity to meet that demand. That
okay.
acts as kind of a battery. That's one way. We can do it.
Can do it.
Storage.
That's interesting. So now the dam, when you're talking about the blades and stuff like that, so the water with, and then one of the things with, you're talking about being part of the Lawrence economy, you have this plant here and you're generating electricity that goes to the grid
mm-hmm.
and that comes back. How many, when you talk about the amount of energy you create, how, what's your kind of, how many, how do you correlate that into homes and to, you know, businesses and stuff.
It how many homes we serve depends on how much electricity our people are consuming,
mm-hmm.
right? So on a hot day in July, we're serving a lot fewer homes than we are in January
mm-hmm.
when people, a lot of people rely on natural gas for their home heat, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but air conditioning
yeah.
is a big consumer. So, you know, but conservatively speaking, at the South Powerhouse, we served about 1,300 homes,
so okay.
between 1,300 and 1,500 homes. And we're going to be able to triple the amount of energy that we produce annually. So, I mean, I'm really ballparking this, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you're looking at 4,500 homes that get served by
okay.
Bowersock. And those okay. homes, I mean, where does that energy really get used? Well, it's probably consumed all within six blocks of Bowersock, you know, but that's where it gets a little bit complicated because
mm-hmm.
we're actually selling the energy to the Kansas City Board of Public Utilities. And
okay.
we're very glad to be partnered with them.
Okay. Now they are the kind of the energy kind of powerhouse in this area.
Well, Westar, like we're actually in Westar's territory.
Okay.
And we used to always sell to Westar, but then starting in 2008, we started to be able to sell to other people, and that has to do with a lot of rules made by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission,
mm-hmm.
et cetera. Kansas City Board of Public Utilities is the entity that serves Wyandotte County in Kansas City, Kansas.
Okay.
And it's a municipal power group.
Okay.
So if you nobody really has any choice in the United States, or here at least in Kansas, on in who we buy our energy from. So if you live in Lawrence, you got to buy from Western Energy.
Right.
You can't shop around.
Mm-hmm.
And if you live in Kansas City, Kansas, you're buying from Kansas City Board of Public Utility. And it just so happens that they have a large municipal utility. That's how they do it. Here over in Lawrence, we have an investor-owned utility, and Lawrence is a franchisee. So Lawrence basically has to buy their power from Westar. And the two entities operate, they do the same thing. A public power does mm-hmm. it, but it's almost like, do you have city-managed trash pickup, or do they bring in Deffenbaugh to do it?
Mm-hmm.
It's similar in the power industry, and in KCBPU in Kansas City, they have municipal power.
Okay.
So, we're a great fit. I mean, we weren't necessarily such a good fit for Westar because they're really generation heavy, and they're not necessarily that excited about buying generation that somebody else generated and then having to resell it. It doesn't necessarily fit their business model.
Oh, so they're more of producing their own.
Yeah, they've got their own energy. So, I mean,
uh-huh.
they're not really, I mean, no knock on Westar for this point. You know, it's not as good for them as good for us, whereas BPU is generation short. So it makes sense for BPU to buy it from us and sell it to their consumers. You know, in the case of the Kansas Power Pool, that we that was our last contract. You know, we used to sell to Westar that sold to them. Well, it made more sense for us to sell to KPP because, you know, it was better for us and it was better for the Kansas Power Pool and better for their consumers in the long run. And so when we go into this next section, we can we'll start looking at the consumer and why hydro is so great for consumers and how we can get more hydro.
And I also want to talk about how one of the things, too, is just with the plant, as you're saying, going online, how you've gone online and how that process of, is it, you know, a ramp up in process or is it just all at one time and kind of the whole process of ramping up and getting online and how you guys are doing over there.
Okay. Well, in the next segment, we'll talk about how we got our new plant online, and then we can talk about hydro as a big, as an entity, you know, what's happening with that industry.
That sounds great.
Right here on the News and Talk of Lawrence, 1320 KLWN.
Try something different for breakfast this weekend with your family. Run over to Sandbar Subs inside of Zarco 66 Oasis and pick up some of those beach bum breakfast burritos, biscuits, and gravy. Take those home to the family this weekend for
rain or drizzle, gusty south winds, high of 63.
From the 1320 KLWN Weather Center, I'm meteorologist John Weatherby.
News and Talk of Lawrence, 1320 KLWN, continuing with the Lawrence Business Magazine show once again, and Frame Herzog.
Thank you. I'm here with Sarah Hill Nelson, the CEO of Bowersock Mills and Power Company. But I want to talk a little bit before we go on, just to let our listeners know that the Lawrence Business Magazine is published quarterly and available at our local Hy-Vees, the Merck, and other convenient merchants around town. And you can now pick up a copy of the Business Magazine in front of Milton's and the Eldridge downtown in our little new outdoor boxes. They're pretty cool looking. You can also it's also available online at lawrencebusinessmagazine.com. And you can submit questions and comments for our guests at questions@lawrencebusinessmagazine.com. And like us on Facebook, where you can find out updates and information on the radio show and magazine. We love to get your comments and questions, but in our effort to encourage an open dialogue, we ask that you put your name on it. So before we left, Sarah and I were talking about the power plant and kind of some of the stuff that's happening there. And let's get back to kind of what you're doing and how the plant, what's happening at the plant.
Well, we'll jump right in. So now that everybody's kind of gotten an idea of sort of the grid and how electricity works, I mean, we've had the last month, I really have to give a shout out to the boys at the plant. We have an awesome staff.
That's
and Rich Foreman's our plant manager, and our lead man's Mark Maxwell, and their two main assistants right now are Matt Marquette and Bruce Vance, and those guys have been working really hard getting all of our equipment installed. So today's Thursday, Tuesday.
Okay.
So 2 days ago, we got our last unit online and producing electricity, and it was
cranking
it out. Thank you. It hasn't really hit me yet, I don't think. I'm not sure I'm really going to be able to breathe till it rains because we really need rain badly.
Now, you've been working on getting this new power plant.
Oh, yeah.
For how long?
Well, we really started it for real in the first real step we took was in fall of 2007.
Okay.
And then it really became real when we got our plant manager, Rich Foreman, in the spring of 2008. We could see that Rich had the capability to do this. I said to my daughter the other day, I said, God, you don't really remember Mama not working on the plant, do you?
That's wild.
So in her memory, she doesn't remember, you know, but we've been through the ma getting this thing done and went through really tough financing. I mean, one night I came home and my kids had little signs up, you can do it, Mama.
Oh,
you know, it's been a real challenge. But so our guys, you know, they installed all these units, they have to install the turbines, and then we flooded the plant. We started flooding it on Halloween.
Okay.
And so you get all the water in there, and then you just start spinning the units, and they have to lubricate everything and make sure everything's spinning just right. It all has to be perfectly balanced. So they'll be spinning the units for a while and making sure the brakes are working, et cetera. And then our first two units, the used units, the Georgia units, went online on the 7th of November.
Okay.
We were able to get those spinning and cranking out. And then We got our last two units online basically between Monday and Tuesday, and they were just cranking it out. I mean, we had the units, the two new Chinese units were making 1.5 megawatts apiece. Well, the whole South, they were making more than that even, you know, so they were performing beyond expectations. And that the South powerhouse is 2.3 megawatts.
Wow.
2.35. So, and then there was this one, here's this one unit making. And
that's
so,
amazing.
Yeah, it's really big, you know, very, I think we were going to have to take a moment to really reflect and be grateful for how far we've gotten and then do some rain dances. Because we really, right now, honestly, mm-hmm. We really can, we're on the bubble. We really almost can't use the North powerhouse. Because there's just not enough water.
Okay.
Because those four big units take about 1,000 cubic feet per second.
Wow.
And they're right now, I mean, the median flow in the river this time of year would be about 2,300, I think. It's 23, 25, something like that. And we have, yesterday all day, 717 cubic feet per second. I mean, we are so dry. And so we're just having to operate out of the south plant. So, I mean, you could say, oh, sad, you know, you built this big, giant new plant, you can't even run it. And I will say that I lie awake at night thinking about that. but you just can't worry about that. You got to put your heads down. And we got the guys already coming back over and doing some work on the south side. You know, we really kind of had to let the south side slide for a little bit. And they're really getting busy doing that. And, you know, we still have a lot of work to do cleaning stuff up on the north side. And that's, I think... keeping those guys busy and being able to have better economies of scale, I mean, that's a big driver for us.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, one of the things, too, when you're talking about, you know, when you have a drought and when it's been so dry, you know, you think about the crops and stuff like that and then how it affects so many different things when you don't have the rainfall that you want.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I mean, and one of our new guys, he joined us last January, and I was talking with him about it and how he had, you know, spent time growing up on a farm, and he's like, oh, I just feel like I'm a farmer again. You know, we're always watching and it's true. You're constantly watching the weather. You're looking at the river coming down. We're very integrated with weather patterns. I think a lot of people kind of go through life and they're like, oh, geez, it hasn't rained for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we're so involved in that and you're immersed in sort of what does it feel like? And are we going to have a rainstorm? So I like that piece of being integrated with the
environment.
The
really.
Environment.
Yeah.
I mean, we're intimately connected, and the guys are out in it every day. And so,
well, talking about that too, just the environment and stuff, the hydroelectric power and how it's green energy.
Yeah.
Because when people talk about, you know, I mean, and how it works with the environment, how it is not, how it, we're taking energy that's created, that you're using. That's been created, but it's not. But it's green energy because it's not polluting.
Well, it's really. I mean, that's one of the greatest things about hydro, and particularly incremental hydro. You know, we have this dam here, and we thought we weren't maximizing it. We weren't utilizing it to its full extent, and so now we've got this new powerhouse on there, and we're not going to waste any of that water going over the dam, and all that energy that we create. There's no pollution that goes along with that. And so every day, you know, we can be, and all we're doing is harnessing the power of the falling water. We're not consuming the water. So it's still available for everybody to use. We're just basically borrowing the water, running it through our powerhouse, and sending it on downriver for the other consumers to use. So hydro is something that people don't think about a lot in Kansas, but I want people to start thinking about it more. Because there's potential for low-head hydro in Kansas. And our senators...
Say what you mean by low-head.
Oh, low-head. Thank you. Okay, so high-head would be like in the mountains, where that water's really falling a long way. And you can generate a lot of electricity, because it's really about the pressure of that downward water that's forcing that turbine, that fan blade, to spin. But you can do low-head hydro, like what we have at the Bowersock Dam. And, you know, hydro really fell out of favor, I think, in the 70s. I consider myself an environmentalist, but... the environmental movement really kind of went against hydro, and primarily because it was being installed in places where it really did have a significant environmental impact, like in the Pacific Northwest with the salmon, and, you know, they're building these huge dams. But that's what's so, to me, appealing about low-head hydro and things, applications in the Midwest. You know, we don't have any salmon in the Kansas River. We're not interrupting anybody's migratory
flow. That's what I was going to ask. So,
with
the habitats and things like that, that's not...
We're not adversely impacting any threatened or endangered species. So here we have all these little dams all over Kansas. Can we not be putting little hydropower generating stations on all those dams? And that's something that really interests me. And I think, you know, for people to reach out to their congresspeople, because for one, hydro in many cases on a federal level is not even considered renewable, which it's the ultimate renewable energy.
Yeah.
And so for people to reach out and say, hey, you know, we need to be supporting hydro. We as a nation need to be developing our own reliable domestic energy production that we know is going to last. Mm-hmm. You know, we only have so much coal. We only have so much natural gas. And I'm not saying that we don't have to rely on those for a long time. But for the federal government to support the development of domestic renewable energy, to me, means good planning. Mm-hmm. It means protection of the economy, and it means great jobs while it's happening. I mean, we were a Recovery Act project, and I cannot tell you how good it felt to stand out there and watch over 105 guys, you know, from time to time on that job, knocking it out, getting really good, you know, union wages. And so hydropower production like that means domestic jobs, and it means economic growth.
Well, when you're talking about something, just things that developing something that's long term, I mean, when you talk about some of those of your turbines that you got from the 1930s, and they've been renovated and still using them. Obviously, it's something that can last a long time.
Well, what's so great about that? What's so great about that is that it's very high capital cost. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's costly in the beginning, but that plant's going to last 200 years. And so for the consumer, okay, is everybody listening? This is your take home. So hydropower is over the life of the project, it's the cheapest form of energy for the consumer over the life of a project. Okay, so if what we're trying to do is guarantee long-term low energy prices, mm-hmm. what can we do as a nation to encourage the development of more hydro that's gonna deliver over time cheaper energy to the consumer? Mm-hmm.
Environmental.
It's cheap. It's domestic. It's green. Mm-hmm. And you know exactly what it's going to cost you because you've already built the building. So mm-hmm. you're not going to be paying for that fuel. So people can count on what that energy is going to cost them. If you're generating coal-fired energy or you're generating natural gas, you have no idea what your fuel is going to cost you 2 months from now. Right now, mm-hmm. today, natural gas is cheap. It's looking good. But if you watch natural gas markets over time, you see massive fluctuations in those prices. So you can go out and build all these gas-fired plants and go, yeah, we're going to be bringing it in here really cheap. Gas-fired gas prices go up for whatever mm-hmm. reason, and all of a sudden your energy is really costly. Mm-hmm. So whereas if you're looking at hydro, you have no changes in fuel costs.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Now, I mean, here's your other take home. Mm-hmm. And I talked about this with you earlier, but the listeners don't know that of all of the dams that are out there in the United States, think to yourselves for a minute, how many dams have hydropower production on them? Or give yourself a percentage in your head. And then I'll tell you that it's 3%. So that's a lot of dams all over the United States that don't have hydropower production on them.
And then, well, I mean, that's incredible, because when you're talking about 3%, not every dam is right
appropriate.
But I would imagine there's a huge percent or large percentage of those that are.
Oh yeah.
With a small footprint, basically.
And there's great technology coming out to be able to take more advantage of low head, again meaning that short fall between mm-hmm. the upstream and the downstream. So, you know, what fascinates me, what excites me, is the idea of looking at all these little reservoirs in Kansas and saying, "Okay, where can we put hydro? Where's it going to be applicable? Who's going to be the buyer?" You know, mm-hmm. what kind of hurdles do we have to get through to get this thing done? And I think a lot of people nationally have felt a little bit jealous of our project because they felt that Kansas, the regulatory hurdles here were not as high,
okay.
that we were able to work through that. And I think that has to do with a couple things. Number one, the environmental impact is not as big,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's the biggest driver. Of course, the hurdles aren't as high because we're not killing salmon.
You also did have a dam there already. Did that help?
Oh, yeah. It's all about site selection. But the other thing is that I feel that we are a small enough community. We earned this low impact hydropower status before we did our new plant. And mm-hmm. we had to work with all the state and federal agencies and all the NGOs in Kansas. non-governmental organizations. Sorry. Like the Sierra Club and the Friends of the Ka and all those groups. So, you know, we had those relationships,
mm-hmm.
and I really got to know all these people. So in my experience, I found that all these people, I mean, I'm an environmentalist. I understand regulation. I get it. I see why we have it. So then you work with these people and you say, okay, here's our goal. Can you help us accomplish it? I mean, in my experience with all of our regulatory people in Kansas, they could not have been more helpful
to us.
Yeah.
That's great.
I mean, and so I think that there was some other people, you know, on the national scene. Oh, it must have been easier for you guys. How'd you guys get that done? I said, well, our agencies are good to work with.
Well, one of the things about, and one of the wonderful things about being in Kansas is people actually are much more accessible when you're dealing with government entities. I know that when we moved back here from California, just making a call to the state, you actually got people to answer the phone, and return your calls, which we practically fell out of our chair the first time it happened. Right. They called back within 2 hours. It was unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's so many great things about our state, and that is one of them. And so I think, but it's a model. And what I hope is that we've been able to do this and that we'd be able to see more hydropower in the state of Kansas.
That'd be great. Now, one of the things, we got to wrap up here. We got a couple of minutes. But one of the things, too, as you're talking about moving forward, are you trying to create a plan here to help these other areas develop power? What is your future here?
Well, I've had lots of people talk to me about it. I mean, for the moment.
You're going to just work on your own project?
I got to keep my head down. I have got a lot of stuff we have to get through. You know, we need it to rain. For me, it's just interesting. It's exciting. It continues to, and I don't know how I might be involved in it, but I feel we put together such a good team doing this project. Touch wood, you know, we're not 100% done yet, but, you know, we got her done, and we got her done on time, and, you know, we were on budget, and it seems to me, I would love to be able to, I hate to lose all of this collective knowledge that we have developed and experienced. So who knows what will happen.
Well, thank you, Sarah. Hopefully that you will be able to share, you are sharing your knowledge now, and hopefully as we go forward, we can develop more of this great energy across the state and this country. So I want to thank you for being here. We've got to wrap up. And basically, let you know that the Lawrence Business Magazine is available online at lawrencebusinessmagazine.com. And like us on Facebook for updates. And where you can also find information about who our next guests are going to be. The Lawrence Business Magazine, every Thursday morning at 9 a.m. here on KLWN, redefining the concept of business.
1320 KLWN, Lawrence.
Try something different for breakfast this weekend with your family. Run over to Sandbar Subs inside of Zarco 66 Oasis and pick up some of those beef.